Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and welcome to the pack-breaking table once again, as by your choice, we're going to open up two packs from the heart of the junk wax era, or as some people will call it, the junk wax error, as the baseball cards were just going crazy in the early 1990s, and I offered up four packs for you to choose from. Two from 1990, a Score Wax pack and a Fleer Cello pack, and then two from 1991, a Leaf Series 2 wax pack and a Topps Stadium Club Series 1 wax pack. And some very interesting results from that selection, which I will get to in just a moment. But first of all, I am your host, Matt Salmon. I thank you so much for joining me once again as we continue our summer revival of Wax Ecstatic. And I want to thank everybody who has passed along the word to their friends about the Wax Ecstatic podcast. And I ask you to please continue to do so again. As, you know, one of the good things about taking a break from doing Wax Ecstatic for as long as I did, 9 months, was, you know, I was able to, you know, do everything else that I need to do in my life and kind of reset, you know, mentally where I wanted to take this show. The bad thing is that you kind of, you know, you're out of sight, out of mind. So again, if you haven't already, just tweet out our hashtag at Wax, or not our hashtag, I should say our handle, at Wax and Gum Stains to your card collecting friends, past or present, and let them know that the show is back up and running, and I think it's kind of good. And we'll keep it going through the summer. And like I said, after that, once hockey season starts, if you didn't know, I work for an NHL team, and things get rather busy starting in September. But, you know, once hockey season starts, we'll see how frequently we do it. But as for now, we'll be doing it every Friday at noon Eastern is when the show is released. And not only the audio version that you're listening to right now, but we put out a video link so you can see me break into these packs here and open up some junk wax in some cases, some nice vintage stuff in others, and just a nice little time reminiscing about certain sets, certain cards, and certain players along the way. Also, I want to thank you if you have made a donation to our PayPal account. That's paypal.me/waxecstatic. I really appreciate it. We've had a few people chip in a few bucks here and there. Like I said, I don't do this show for money. It's very hard to make a living off podcasting, trust me. But, you know, this is a labor of love. It's just, you know, something that I started a few years ago on a whim, grew into something far bigger than I ever expected it to. But even after the break, or during the break that I took, you know, a lot of people were pining for it. So I appreciate it if you, you know, do have the opportunity to throw in just a few bucks here or there. The money does go to a good purpose. No, not into my pocket necessarily. It goes to pay the support fees, if you will, for the hosting of these programs on Audioboom. Also keeps the archive up and running. Also, it does kind of balance out the amount of time I spend on doing this podcast. Even though it is a labor of love, it still takes 2 to 3 hours to put together this show every week. And, you know, hey, I've got a busy life, so it's, you know, you got to find that work-life hobby balance, and certainly any donation goes a long way there. But I think more importantly for the program, any donation you make through the Wax Ecstatic PayPal account will go back into the purchase of packs that we get to break here. I'm working off of a stash of packs that I bought at a local card shop, also a few packs I bought through an eBay purchase. So those will last for a few weeks. But I have had some luck recently of getting some vintage wax at decent prices. Not with Wax Ecstatic funds, but with my own personal funds. I've recently purchased an unopened pack of 74 and 75 tops, and I'm very excited because now I have a pack for each year from 74 through 79, and that's getting a lot harder to get. But I've got that going, and, you know, again, donations will help me forge through the opportunities, not only of some vintage wax, you know, and I'm talking more late 70s, early 80s. I know that's a big hit with a lot of our listeners, so I want to try to replenish those stocks and open up a few of those. In fact, I think I've got an extra 77 Topps wax pack. I might, might open, because those things are selling for $40-$50 a pop now on eBay, but I might open it on a show. You never know. But again, you know, if we've got the funds, we'll go out and we'll search for that stuff. And if we can get a good deal and get it from a reputable dealer so we know it truly is an unopened, unsearched pack, we will definitely do that. Also, I'm kind of watching a few auctions that are out there. I've had quite a few listeners say, hey, why don't you, you know, get some cards from 1955 and 56 or earlier and do shows on that? And yeah, I will do that. But as I, you know, mentioned in our show last week, you know, I want to actually purchase the cards myself and then discuss them with you. So while I appreciate offers of, hey, I'll send you some cards, nah, hang on to them. You know, especially if you're talking about cards from the 1950s, don't just give them to me. Hang on to them, okay? And you know, I will make a purchase or two or three over the next few weeks. And once those cards come in, as opposed to a pack break, we'll look at a lot of maybe, you know, five or six cards from some of the earlier years and talk about the card sets and maybe a little bit about the players that are featured on them. One last housekeeping note before we talk about the poll for our packs that we're opening this week. I do have a lot of vintage cards, mostly 70s, but a couple from 1968. It is a lot of 80 cards. There are a few duplicates in there specifically from 1978, 79, I believe. Not that many. But if you are interested in purchasing those, and there's not really, there's a few semi-star cards here, but, you know, we're not talking about a, you know, a Mike Schmidt rookie, okay, or anything like that. But we are talking about just, you know, a collection of cards, mostly from the 1970s. You're looking to just add to your vintage collection or, you know, just looking to fill some gaps in some 1970s sets that you're, you know, trying to complete. If you're interested in buying them, please DM Wax and Gum Stains and let me know. I will tell you that most of these cards are in, I would say, excellent, very good condition. Some of them are actually in pretty decent shape, you know, a little closer to the, you know, semi-near mint, if you will. But a lot of them, I mean, you know, they're 40-year-old cards. They've been through the ringer. So, you know, some of them have a couple of creases and rounded corners. Others are fairly decent. Really, they're just duplicates in my collection. I want to hand them off to somebody else who would appreciate them. So if you're interested in buying them, I will put the starting price at $10 for the lot. Again, 80 cards, starting with a couple from 1968. Most of the set is from the 1970s, mostly 78, 79. There's quite a few from 73 in there as well. I can send you pictures, but looking at $10, and basically I came to that price because 80 cards at 10 cents a piece is $8. $2 covers the shipping and handling, and they're yours. And I just, you know, again, I could just throw them in a donation box somewhere. I could just have them sitting on my shelf forever, but I would rather give them to somebody at a fair price who just wants to add to a vintage collection. So again, DM me at Wax and Gum Stains if you're interested, and we can work out the details of the cards themselves, and I can send you a few pictures as well. All right, now as for this week's show, we've got some very interesting things to discuss. A question that came back from one of our listeners that was fascinating. Not necessarily the question, with all due respect to it, but the responses we got. We'll get to that in a moment. But later on in the program, we are going to open up a pack of 91 Top Stadium Club and 90 Score. And what's interesting about this poll question, and this is kind of the direction the show is going in for the time being, I will put up a selection of three or four packs from typically the late 80s or early 90s. But like I said before, there will be some from earlier parts of the decade that we'll, you know, let you choose from. And for 24 hours on Twitter, we just let you all fight over them. And the top two vote getters are the ones that we open up and discuss. So it was not my surprise, or it was no surprise to me, I should say, that the Top Stadium Club pack was of most interest. That is, you know, of the four that we offered up there, again, 91 Top Stadium Club, 91 Leaf Series 2, 90 Fleer Cello, and 90 Score Wax. Top Stadium Club was going to be by far the most popular. It's still, you know, very valuable because they were in limited numbers compared to other sets that were produced in 1991. And they're very high quality. In fact, if you go back in our archives, and you listen to the 91 Top Stadium Club show, which is episode 47, featuring Roberto Alomar, I rave about 91 Top Stadium Club. I've always said that in 1989, Upper Deck raised the bar. And for the next 2 years, all the other card sets that were being made were just in the shadows of Upper Deck. And some cards were starting to move up the ladder just a little bit. But Top Stadium Club really not only met that bar, but I think exceeded it. And then this drove the part of the hobby where premium cards started overtaking the standard base set, which could be a good thing or a bad thing. It was a good thing because you got some really nice cards that were released then and were, you know, valued more than the base sets. But the downside, of course, is it started, you know, outpricing kids. The cards got more expensive to collect, got a little harder to try to collect, you know, your favorite team or your favorite player. And, you know, it was kind of downhill from there. By 1992, everybody had, you know, this particular, you know, desire to have these premium cards, and the card companies made them, but, you know, they started pricing out, you know, each other and the younger generation of card collectors, which, you know, again, we'll talk about in a moment with the question that was posed on our Twitter feed. But the poll, you know, Stadium Club is running away with the lead. And at first, the Leaf Pack was the number two overall selection. And, you know, the Fleer and the Score ones were, you know, getting some decent number of votes, but nothing really spectacular. And then a funny thing happened. All of a sudden, a whole pile of votes for 90 Fleer came in. And 90 Fleer is one of my favorite sets, even though it is overproduced and there's still plenty of it out there. But if you listen to the episode that we did on that, which was episode 38 featuring John Smoltz, you know, 90 Fleer, I've got a personal connection to it. I love the set, love the design. It's fun to look at and open up those cards again. But I was really surprised. I'm like, okay, 90 Fleer, are you kidding me? The Leaf set started going down and down, and then in the final few hours of our poll, 90 Score started emerging. We talk about 90 Score in episode 37 featuring David Wells, and at the end of the poll, by a narrow margin, in fact, probably just one vote, 90 Score finishes second. So when we open up these packs later on in the program, we'll look at Top Stadium Club, which should be fun to open up again if all the cards aren't sticking together, and 90 Score, which was one of my favorite sets in terms of design. It is very representative of 1990 with the colors and the funny word marks and you know, everything else. It was a nice rebound set for Score, because I think their 1989 set was by far the worst set of baseball cards in 1989. Yes, I'm putting 89 Score beneath 89 Bowman. I actually like 89 Bowman, but I'm putting it way down there because it was just an absolute turd after their premier edition in 1988. So later on in the program, we will talk about the 91 Top Stadium Club and 90 Score packs. We'll open them up. And thanks again to everybody who participated in that poll there, because we got a lot of great responses, and it's going to be fun opening up some of these old packs once again. Now, I got a question. In fact, on our Twitter feed on Wednesday, I just threw out a tweet that said, hey, if you have any questions or comments for the show, you know, go ahead and post them. And I got a question from Fred Harris, or you may know him as Fred C. Harris, one of the authors of the Great American Baseball Card Flipping, Trading, and Bubblegum book, which he notes is called the Spinal Tap of Baseball Books. If you have read the book Cardboard Gods, I think you like how they kind of take a little poke at some of the baseball cards that were produced, especially in the mid to late 70s. And it's a great book, Cardboard Gods is, and was, I have to admit, kind of a little bit of an inspiration for me to kind of go through some of the old card sets of my own personal collection. But when Fred offered up his question, which originally was, where did all the kids go? I responded with a question mark because that was just such a vague question. And, you know, I had just watched a Marx Brothers movie and I was about to reply, I don't know where they went, but their mother's worried sick about them. And that's what you get when you watch a Marx Brothers movie. You just become a smartass. But Fred responded, when and why did kids abandon the hobby? And I said, that's a great question. We're going to discuss it on the show. And then I turned it around and basically retweeted it to all of you. And I said, offer up your commentary, please. And we got some commentary, great reaction from everybody. And this is no surprise. I mean, those of us who have collected at some point in time, or if you still collect now, this isn't rocket science. We know the reasons why kids have not been as involved in the hobby, much like we were when we were kids. And I just really liked what came in as a response. I will try to boil down those responses into an all-encompassing discussion, because honestly, I could do an entire show, at least an hour, of just talking about this topic, because it is something that not only ails the hobby, but I think ails the game of Major League Baseball. You know, there's all of this talk nowadays of, you know, why is baseball struggling? Why are people not going to the games? Why are ratings in one market worse than the others? And there's all sorts of discussions, and some of them I think are manufactured crises. Like to me, the attendance issue in baseball. Guess what, folks? Major League Baseball doesn't need butts in seats, all right? With collective bargaining and with broadcast deals and with money that is brought in through even things like baseball card sales and merchandising and stuff like that, you don't need 50,000 people in a baseball stadium anymore. In fact, theoretically speaking, if you keep your payroll around $60 to $70 million, you know, in a vacuum, you could have zero people come through your turnstile for an entire season and you break even. And, you know, baseball owners kind of gave up on the idea of, hey, we need to pack the ballparks years ago. That is why a lot of the new stadiums that you're seeing that are being proposed are, you know, in the 30,000 seat range. And it's not just baseball. You know, you're seeing this in football as well, especially the NFL. You know, smaller is better, not only because you don't need the butts in seats, but also you can, you know, charge more for the ticket prices. But, you know, that's another show talking about that. But my point is that, you know, kids not being as involved in baseball cards as they were when we were kids, or at least, you know, if you're my age, I'm 40, so we're talking 25, 30 years ago. You know, if the kids aren't as involved as we once were, then they're not going to be as involved in watching the sport of Major League Baseball. So, you know, I think, you know, kids not being part of the hobby is an issue. So we posed the question, we got a lot of great responses, and I'm going to go through them now. I'm going to offer up just this kind of overall summary, but then I want to offer up another question, and that is, how do we fix it? That will be discussed on next week's show. So let me go through, I'm just going to read through all the comments here, and then like I said, I'm going to boil it down here because this podcast, as much as I love doing it and you love listening to it, it does run kind of long. I don't want to overshoot the runway on our time here. I'm a big believer that if you're having a good conversation in a podcast, keep it going. But I'm also a big believer that, you know, listening to a podcast should not be a slog. So let's see what we can do to kind of boil this conversation down into, you know, 10 or 15 minutes here and see what you said and my response to it. And then we'll try to point the discussion in the other direction, as in, okay, how do we fix it? This is just in chronological order, all right, after I got the question from Fred that we sent out. And by the way, Fred, I need to get my hands on the book, The Great American Baseball Card Flipping, Trading, and Bubblegum Book. I know it was re-released a few years ago, originally done back in the early 70s, by the way. So Fred, well ahead of the curve on some of these baseball card books. But anyways, Fred's question goes out. Here's what we got, again, just in chronological order. Doug McCready, I lost interest in collecting consistently due to a couple simple factors, too many sets and the cost was too high. Older cards have lost value, but I could stare at a set of 71 tops for hours. I can take or leave every card after 1987. And hence how the, you know, term junk wax came about. A lot of people put the junk wax era from 1988 into the mid-90s for some of those exact same reasons. Let's see what else. Matthew Priggy, early 90s would be my guess. Yep. Go Tribe 2018. Define kids. What age are you talking? I'll say 25 and under. Okay, that's fair. He gives us three reasons. One, money. Kids today don't want to work, and if they do, cards aren't their thing. Two, the advancement of video games, especially online play, has kids' interest. And three, games aren't cheap, so compare the cost of one online game versus cards that sit in a box. Brian Hayes, my sense is that kids started leaving the hobby around the 1994 baseball strike and the rise of the internet in the mid-90s. However, I don't think kids have completely abandoned the hobby, but the bigger question is, if kids do in fact abandon ship, would that be such a bad thing? Yes, it would. for the reason I just expressed, I really think one of the reasons why baseball is having a little bit of trouble getting the attention they want, and there's a whole lot of layers to that onion, is again, you know, kids not spending as much time collecting baseball cards. So, Brian, I actually do think it's a bad thing if kids are not involved, but we will talk a little more about that after I get through the comments here. Robert Vincent, late 80s, early 90s, combination of sets being too hard to complete with all the subsets, etc., and cards being released in series instead of one at a time. Very interesting point there. Philly Puck fan, kids want what adults want, but they can't pay the freight. Tops need to do better with entry-level products. Tops opening day is a step in the right direction. Perhaps a five-card stadium club pack for $1 with a guaranteed insert in each pack and a chance at an autograph. Ben Adams, too much product and cost went up. Short and sweet and right on target, too. Tribe Cards, the hobby. All the stupid chase stuff. Kids want to collect their favorite players and teams. Keep it simple. Keep it affordable. Include some goofy pictures. Russ Bear, when I was a kid in the late 70s, I could get a pack for a quarter. I spent a lot of birthday and allowance money on cards. What normal kid can afford a pack of whatever's out there now? Chris Starr, glad to see you back. He, by the way, promotes his friend's show, High and Inside. Okay, this is a little off topic, but Chris, by the way, I will check out the High and Inside podcast. I appreciate you sending me that heads up. Wax Pack 916, cost too many products that focus on hits. A $6 pack has five cards in it. Makes it too hard to build sets. Also, the exclusive licenses do not help. Need more variety, not just from one manufacturer. Steve, a.k.a. Wax Pack 916, I've got some bad news for you, which I will share with you in a moment. But lastly, Kevmo K21, kids 7 to 8 years old need packs with 12 cards in them, not five. A chance for a great autograph and career stats. Career stats have disappeared. You're absolutely right. I used to love flipping over the back of the card and seeing the entire player's career. I hated when Donruss in the early 90s, or early 80s, I mean, really throughout their first, 12, 13 years of existence would only show, you know, the last 5 years of major league experience for a player, which really, you know, truncated the greatness of a George Brett or Nolan Ryan or any of those other star players. But that's a great point. Of course, part of it is now if you want to look at the career numbers for any baseball player, it's baseballreference.com. But, you know, having that tangible piece of history there in your hand, it is missing. Absolutely. And that's a great point that you make. All right. So I took all of those suggestions, as well as the free plug for the High and Inside podcast. And thank you again. I will check that out. And I wrote them down. I added them up. And here in descending order, these are the issues that you all identified as for why kids are not involved in the hobby as much as they used to be. The runaway winner, cost too much. a close second. There are too many sets or too many cards within sets, you know, too many subsets, too many chase cards, that kind of thing. Coming in a tie at third place, there needs to be better value to the cards that are out there, and also competition from video games and the internet. And then getting one vote each, need more competition, as in somebody other than Topps putting out an official product, better entry-level product, so something that's geared a little more towards kids, and the 94 strike, which I still think, and here we are, almost 25 years to the day that it happened, I still think that's a huge reason why baseball's having a problem getting the attention that they desire, because there is an entire generation of people, basically Generation X, if you want to call it. These are the people who are now 35 to 50 years old, which, by the way, is the money demo. This is the broadcaster side of me speaking out here. The people who have made enough money through their career or through their investments, this is that age, 35 to 50, where you're starting to make those big ticket purchases. So if I want to buy season tickets to my local Major League Baseball team, well, you know, I'm not going to be able to just crap out $8,000 or however much they are. I have no idea. But, you know, the very large amount of money it would cost me to buy season tickets or even a partial ticket plan. Because of that 94 strike, that entire generation, like I said, mostly the Generation X group, that is now living in the big dollar, the money demo, we're not doing it. And there's other factors, too. I mean, there's student loan crisis. There's, you know, the economy that wiped out a lot of people's savings 10 years ago, you know, the downturn in the economy. There's a lot of factors to it. But, you know, that you have an entire generation that not all of it came back to baseball. I did. I know some people who are roughly my age, same thing, you know, they came around, but it was actually through baseball cards that they kind of got back into baseball. You know, I just love the sport. Major League Baseball be damned for their stupidity in 1994. But I think that's a big factor, even though it only got one vote in our rather unofficial survey here. So here's just some of the issues with what's been brought up. And, you know, Steve Bowman of Wax Pack 916 fame, I said, I've got some bad news. You're looking for somebody other than Topps to produce these cards. Well, Topps has had their official exclusive license with Major League Baseball and the Players Association extended just recently, just a few days ago, through the year 2025. So Topps has been the exclusive Major League Baseball product for baseball cards since 2010. So they're going to have a 15-year stretch where they are the big dog in town. And even though collectors may complain about not having more options, clearly, if an agreement that was made back, and it started in 2006, I think, with Topps and Upper Deck getting the exclusivity to do this, and this kind of, you know, blew up the hobby, which I think was actually a good thing. It's kind of like when a big company goes through a Chapter 11 bankruptcy. Sometimes you just need to, you know, puke all your nastiness out to get back on your feet. And Topps and Upper Deck did that. But, you know, Topps has had the exclusive right to sell these cards since 2010. And as much as we complain about it, if Major League Baseball and the Players Association continues to extend this deal. You know, at first it was a 3-year extension, then it was a 7-year extension. Now they have a 5-year extension. Clearly, from a financial standpoint, it's working. You know, nobody with Major League Baseball or the Players Association or the Topps Company is extremely upset with how things are going. And also, Topps has been privately owned since 2007. A lot of the times when you have private ownership, you know, it's cut costs, raise revenues, and eventually sell it. There have been talks that the Topps Company may be up for sale, which tells me that their owners are clearly thinking that, okay, we've hit our revenue goals for our ownership, so it's time to dump it. So, you know, clearly it's a money-making venture. So I unfortunately, if you're looking for somebody other than Topps to produce baseball cards, it's not going to happen. Ironically, and I've mentioned this before, with Topps being the only exclusively licensed company through MLB and the MLBPA, there's actually still too many cards because you've got the base set, you've got Heritage, you've got Archives, you've got Bowman Chrome, you've got Topps Stadium Club, you've got Opening Day. You've got all of these various sets just all under the Topps umbrella. So it's kind of a catch-22 there. Costs too much. And there's a reason why so many people see that. And yeah, cost of living has risen in the last 30 years and cost of consumer goods has as well. But, the funny thing about baseball cards is that as the hobby went to more premium sets and subsets and chase cards, you know, the price went up. And this is kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation. If you don't want the price to go up, because these are companies, or, you know, now it's a company that's making this, you know, they've got a profit from this stuff. So if you don't want the cards to be so expensive, if you want to go back to the days of, hey, I want a pack of cards for a dollar or less, that's great. But you're going to get something that is either inferior in quality or overly mass produced to where the value is not there for the collector. And the company is basically just pushing out this mediocre product that they hope people will buy in mass for a dollar a piece. So what happens is you get a lot of those junk wax type sets, the 90 Fleers, the 89 Tops, the 88 Donruss's that are out there. Sets that have their merits to them, but they were so massively produced and the cost was down, but the quality was also down. And there's still literally millions of each card in that set. There are hundreds of millions of cards from the junk wax era still floating out there, unopened, still in factory fresh cases 30 years later. So that's a downside to that. Collectors wanted something that was a little more exclusive, a little more high-end. You know, Upper Deck came around and changed that. Sets like Stadium Club and then, you know, Fleer Ultra and you name it came around in the mid-90s. And, you know, that, you know, punched a hole in that as well. So, again, there's another catch-22 there. If you want a cheaper set to try to get kids into the hobby, they can do that. But hobbyist collectors, people profiting from the hobby, are not going to buy them. And a great case of that is the Donruss Triple Play set from the early 90s. It was a great idea in theory, you know, have a kid themed cooler set that goes out, is cheaper for them to purchase, and is a good introduction for kids to get into the hobby. But the downside to that was, you know, hobby shops were not lining up to get that set. And we talk about the Donruss Triple Play set, in particular the 91 Triple Play in episode 51 with Jeff Bagwell as our feature pull. And we talk a little more about that. So, there's a need for it, but also from the business side, it just doesn't make sense. And as much as we call it a hobby and treat it as a hobby, let's be honest, as much as we don't want it to be, it is still a business. And lastly, video games and internet. I think coupled with the raise in prices and the 94 strike, starting in the mid-90s, video gaming systems became more affordable, were in every household. The internet started to become more affordable in every household in around 96 and 97. And now, I mean, you've got video games. You can play them on your phone. You can play them on a tablet. You don't have to be sitting in your home doing it. And kids are spending their time and money doing that. My son, who is, you know, like I've said before, he's 8 years old. He'll be 9 in a few months. He's a big fan of baseball. He collects baseball cards. But he also likes video games. He's at that age. And he wants to purchase. We just got an iPad. And he wants to purchase the, you know, full version of Minecraft, which is $7.99, which if it keeps my kid quiet on a long road trip, I'm all for it. It's worth every penny, right? Well, $7.99 for a video game that could give him hours upon hours of entertainment. And Minecraft's a pretty good game, in my opinion. you know, $7.99 gets you what? Three packs of Topps baseball cards, the base set. Gets you what? Two packs of Topps Heritage, if you can find it. Because again, the hobby, you know, everyone's chasing particular cards, and now you can't find them on your grocery store shelves. You can't even find them in grocery stores. They're only in Walmart, Target, and I've actually seen packs of cards sold at Bed Bath & Beyond, which is a little confusing. But other than that, local card shops, and there's hardly local card shops anymore. I mentioned last week, I think there's five in the 50-mile radius where I live. There used to be five in my neighborhood growing up. So, yes, there's been, competition from the internet and from video games. Yes, there's the 94 baseball strike. Yes, there's, two expensive cards that are out there. But, you know, as much as we can point the finger at, you know, hey, the baseball card companies are too greedy, or Major League Baseball was stupid with their strike, or, you know, there's just too much, you know, occupying kids' attention now. We have to look at the hobby too, and we have to look at collectors. We are just as guilty, because we were, as you know, teenagers or young adults back in the late 80s and early 90s, we were chasing all of those cards. We were buying up those cases of 89 Upper Deck in the hope of paying off our college loans with Ken Griffey Jr. cards. We were chasing parallels and refractors and autograph cards and, you know, a swatch of Babe Ruth's jockstrap that was, you know, put inside this one baseball card, so it was an authentic piece of merchandise. So we're at fault for this too. You know, yeah, the companies put the stuff out there that raised the price and made it too hard to collect. But guess what? We went after it. Go! Yeah, you know, we're partly at fault, too. So, thank you again to everybody who responded to that question. It's a fun debate to have. And I want to turn it around to you. Okay, we've talked about why kids aren't collecting cards as much as they used to 25, 30 or so years ago. So how do we fix it? There's not an easy solution. And in fact, I will tell you, there is no way that eventually, even if it's 10 or 15 years down the line, just in pure quantity discussion, kids will buy as many baseball cards as we used to buy. But there is a way to keep the hobby going for that next generation. And in the long term, it will help Major League Baseball groom the next generation and try to make up for some, not all, some of what it lost in the Generation X group that was turned off by the strike in 1994. So that's my question to you. How do we fix it? I will share your responses, but also a couple stories next week that gives me hope that the baseball card industry / hobby is not done. It will be in certainly much smaller numbers than when you and I were kids, but I think it still has life, despite the challenges of higher priced cards or too many sets and subsets and chase cards, or too much competition from other forms of entertainment. There is still a lifeline there. I'm not sure how long it will last, but I don't think baseball cards are going away anytime soon. Certainly with Topps and Major League Baseball extending their agreement through 2025, we know we can still collect for the next 7 years. So how do we turn on that next generation? Maybe they're not buying them by the tens of thousands that we used to as kids, but they're still spending a little bit of that hard-earned money, or they're accepting these gifts as treats from adults for doing the chores, good behavior, straight A's on the report card, and they truly enjoy it. So I want to hear from you at Wax and Gum Stains. Put your suggestions out there. We'll prompt it with a question on Twitter over the weekend. But also, we want to, you know, give you a little bit of hope that the next generation will pick up the ball and run with it. And I do have a couple stories that I will share next week. All right, part of the reason why kids are not collecting baseball cards, Top Stadium Club from 1991. That, kids, is what we call a segue in broadcasting. Top Stadium Club was actually a legitimate club for, I forgot how much it was. I want to say it was $29.95. You could buy membership into the Topps Stadium Club and get a special members-only set that was sent to you by Topps. And there were some other things that came with it. But as I mentioned before, Topps Stadium Club really changed the industry, rose it to a whole new level. 1990 Score was a very good set, in my opinion. It does fall into that junk wax era, but I think it's worthy to look at these cards. So what do you say? We open up these packs that you selected, and I'm going to move over to the camera here. Again, different microphones, so it's going to sound a little different if you're listening in. But if you want to follow along, we tweeted out the YouTube link. Take a look at it, and watch as we open these cards up. All right, we've got the four packs that we were showing off earlier in the week. And as I mentioned earlier, the Stadium Club pack, no surprise here. That's one of our winners. But the 90 Score, pulling ahead of the competition, which was 90 Fleer and 91 Leaf, a little bit of a surprise. So I'm going to take these, set these aside. I may open them later or put them in a pack opening for another show. But these are our two winners. Before we open them, I hope you like the new backdrop here, although I've got to break out the iron, it seems. This is the felt baseball diamond that is part of a product, and this is not a paid endorsement. I'm just telling you through my own experience. It's called Baseball Guys, and it's by a company called Caskey Kids. You can see it up here. And they have a website, CaskeyKids.com. And you get this little mini field. You also get a mini scoreboard. You get basically two complete teams of, you know, it's almost like army guys. And your kids can set them up and play a pretend game. My son is starting to grow out of it. He's going to be 9 in a few months. But I can tell you through my experience, if you have a child who I would say is between the age of 4 and 8, and really loves baseball. They also do other sports too, like basketball and soccer and football. They also have some officially licensed college football games. So Alabama, Auburn, Michigan, there's several of them. That is a great gift to give. So again, not a paid endorsement. I'm just going to throw it out there. It was a big hit with my son. We actually started him on their hockey game, and then he wanted baseball and soccer and college football and you name it. So it's a real winner. I think they cost about $30 or $35. But like I said, if you've got a kid who loves sports, he or she will be spending hours with that game. Also, adults, you know, you may want to set it up yourself. It's kind of a neat package there. All right, speaking of packaging, we're going to unwrap, if you will, the Stadium Club in just a few minutes. But we're going to start with the 90 Score pack here. And as I've mentioned in previous podcasts, 90 Score, or Score in general, was actually way ahead of the curve. There's no doubt that Upper Deck changed the hobby in 1989 with its premiere release. But a lot of the things that Upper Deck gets credit for, Score actually started, including the tamper-proof packaging. Although I believe Sports Flix may have had similar packaging back in the mid-80s. But I know Score was the first longer-lasting set to take advantage of this. So you have the plastic wrapper here that was supposed to, you know, turn away thieves who would, you know, finger through these cards and, you know, unwrap, look through them, wrap them up again. That was no longer the case with a product like Score, although Upper Deck, again, gets all of the credit because of their foil packaging, which was just as theft resistant, honestly, as this plastic packaging. Also, Score had great photography. They had the full color photo of the player on the back as well. They started doing that in 1988 with their premier edition. And great stats, great scouting reports on players. Score was one of my favorite sets back in the late 80s and early 90s, with the exception of the 1989 set. Very boring design, very dull, didn't quite live up to the hype of some of the other sets that were being made. But 1990 was a big year for Score, and they came out with a truly 1990 design, as you will see, as I call it, the Tony design. It is all 1990, you know, Will Smith and just that kind of a look. And here we go. Starting with Nelson Liriano. That's a great action shot there, by the way. But as I'm talking about with the 1990 design, vibrant colors around the borders, and you can see, you know, we'll go through each of them in just a minute. But, you know, that was a big thing for Score, always very colorful, with the exception of the 1989 set. The 1990 typeface here, full logo here, I love that. And of course, being a Blue Jays fan when I was a kid, that was great. Even though Nelson Liriano was not a huge star, by any stretch of the imagination, I mean, look at, you know, the detail of the photo, all of the information here. In the scouting report, in fact, with Liriano's, it starts with, Nelson was the biggest spoiler in the majors in 89. Within 5 days in April, he broke up Nolan Ryan's no-hitter in the ninth inning with a one-out triple and spoiled Kirk McCaskill's no-hitter with a ninth inning leadoff pinch-hit double. Great stuff there. Greg Olson, relief pitcher, closer for the Orioles back in the late 80s and early 90s. We've got Frank Tanana, who could still throw some heat in his later years here with the Detroit Tigers. Omar Vizquel with the Seattle Mariners. Guillermo Hernandez of the Detroit Tigers, looking like he's exerting a lot of energy there. Mitch Wild Thing Williams in his Chicago Cubs days. Also, before we get to this special card, this was the insert that you found in scorecards, a little trivia, kind of sports flickish things. So the MVPs, American League 1983, you flip it over and it gives you the story of Cal Ripken Jr.'s MVP season. Great picture here of the late Kirby Puckett, part of the Dream Team inserts. I shouldn't call it an insert. As you can see, it was clearly part of the regular set here, card number 690, but a nice, stark, different card from what you got from the rest of them. You know, you compare it to this Rick Rushel card here with the wild 90s look. This one much more reserved. It was great. So there's Rushel. There's Dale Maharsic, I can never say his name right, from the Yankees. Brian Harper, utility man and mostly catcher extraordinaire with the Twins. Sean Abner of the San Diego Padres in that great brown pinstripe uni of the time. Wes Gardner of the Red Sox. We've got Mark Williamson of the Orioles. Scott Cooper, your big rookie card. Yeah, he was heralded. He was going to be the next Wade Boggs. Oops. And let's see, Keith Miller of the Mets. And Ryan Sandberg, a highlight card. Again, not really an insert, so to speak. It was part of the base set. But a nice little card to wrap up that pack there featuring Rhino. All right, let's get to Stadium Club. As I mentioned earlier, this, you know, Upper Deck changed the game in 89, but Topps Stadium Club in 1991 really raised the bar with the full photo front, the vibrant colors, as you can see here, you know, Kodak quality photographs, and really just a great design. A nice card there on the back, Bull Clark, we'll get to that in a moment. Delino DeShields with the Montreal Expos. Let me flip this card over. Now, this is the downside of some of these cards from the 90s. The UV coating, they stick. So that poses a problem if you're opening these today and hoping for a good deal. But here's the great design. I've always loved the different way of presenting stats on the back. I thought it was a very unique change from the standard baseball card then. And just being a history nerd and a fan of the hobby, showing the player's rookie card, which, of course, was always a Topps card. There were some other cards of Delino DeShields, but it was always the Topps product. So we got Delino DeShields. Let's peel apart our next card here. Whoops. Steve Sachs of the New York Yankees, before he had immeasurable long-term fame being associated with the Springfield baseball episode of The Simpsons, which would have been about a year later. Alan Trammell of the Detroit Tigers. Great action shot there again. And also using the horizontal shot here, utilizing the entire field there. Great shot of him putting the ball into play. And again, you know, as a fan of the game and as of the hobby, and this was, you know, 1991, we're talking pre-internet days here. This was the only way you could see Alan Trammell's rookie card, unless you had it. And, of course, the best part about Alan Trammell's rookie card is he also shared one with Paul Molitor in the 1978 set. All right, Lenny Harris of the Dodgers there. We got the insert card here. Let's take a look at this. This isn't a top fur ball, but the Top Stadium Club bars. This was their flashy new way of showing the information on the back. We'll talk a little bit about that later. And you also had, let's see, what was this incredible deal here? Ah, for complete bars information on 12 of the top players on each team, order these exclusive Stadium Club books. And then it was not only exclusive, but extremely expensive for something back then. All right, we've got Jose Uribe. Again, the UV coating. Oh, cracks. Ooh. Danny Tartable of the Royals. One of the more underappreciated players of his time. Probably because Kansas City was a pretty average team back then. They were good, slightly above average, but certainly not the attention that he got when he was with the Yankees. Great rookie card there with the Mariners. Mackie Sasser, one of the great baseball names from that era. Catching for the Mets. Here we go, peeling these cards again. My goodness. Yeah, and you can even see there's a little bit of like residue on the back there. John Burkett. Yeah, you see a little bit of the blue here peeling off because of the UV coating. Tim Jones, you know, here's one of those just nonchalant pictures that Stadium Club would utilize, and Upper Deck really made a feature of their sets later on, but just this nice little, you know, Tim Jones, most people didn't know, you know, who he was unless you were a Cardinals fan, but, you know, just a great natural photograph of him goofing off before a game at Shea Stadium. There we go, Mitch Williams again, really looking like Wild Thing there. He's looking like an ostrich or a flamingo. Great rookie card with the Texas Rangers, the 86 Topps traded set. Luis Polonia, speedster with the California Angels, of course starting his career with the Oakland Athletics. And we got Will the Thrill Clark there sliding into third base in San Diego. The Topps traded rookie card on the back, and a nice way to finish that pack. All right, back of the good microphone here. Let me sit down here. Well, some interesting cards there, and I want to pull out the Bars card from the Topps Stadium Club set. This was basically fancy stats. You know, we get lost in sabermetrics nowadays, but I always liked how Topps tried to reinvent the statistics on the back of the card. If you wanted the full stats of your favorite player, that's what the base set was for. But if you wanted a different way of looking at numbers, then you could see it on the Stadium Club. By the way, BARS stood for Baseball Analysis and Reporting System, a scouting way of describing batting average and at-bats and tendencies. So I always liked that. I thought it was kind of neat. But you could, via this card, you could get information on 12 of the top players on each team. There was one for the American League with 168 players, one for the National League with 144 players. And if you were a Stadium Club member, you could get both books for only $13.20. And then if you weren't a Stadium Club member, it was $22.20 for both books. And that goes back to what I was saying about the Stadium Club membership. And that was, you know, another detriment to the hobby, because the only people who could afford this were either hobby shop owners or, you know, big dollar collectors, or the rich kids. So, you know, if you didn't have a lot of money in your family, and, you know, you or your family didn't have a lot of disposable income, guess what? You can't get the fancy stuff from Topps Stadium Club. And that extends down to the more premium brands as well that emerged in the early to mid-90s. A lot of kids couldn't afford it, which is rather unfortunate. But, you know, that's part of the history, which, you know, we've got to work past here. All right, let's take a look, not at all the cards here, but let's take a look at some of the cards that we pulled here from the Stadium Club pack. First, Delino DeShields, an outstanding infielder for the Montreal Expos, but don't tell that to Dodgers fans, because Delino DeShields, as you're probably well aware of, part of one of the most lopsided trades in modern baseball history. You could argue this was worse than the Doyle Alexander for John Smoltz trade in 1987 with Detroit. But Doyle Alexander was acquired for a playoff push in 1987. It did get the Tigers past Toronto to win the American League East that year. And, you know, John Smoltz was not a very highly sought prospect at the time. In fact, as we discussed in that 1990 Fleer podcast, he wasn't very impressive, to be honest with you. So, you know, at the time it made sense, but the Dodgers traded Pedro Martinez in the deal for Delino DeShields. And, of course, that wasn't, you know, the only player that was involved in that deal. But, you know, DeShields, who was supposed to shore up a god-awful infield that the Dodgers had alongside Jose Offerman, or as Dodgers fans would call him, Jose Offelman, who just basically had a cinder block for a glove. He was a terrible defensive player. Well, DeShields was not able to, you know, recreate the magic that he had in Montreal after that trade in the winter of 1993. He had only 241, but had a pretty good career. Had 268 career batting average. His kid's very much involved in sports. As you know, Delino DeShields Jr., a member of the Texas Rangers, and a constant reminder to us fans that we're getting older because the kids of the players cards you collected are playing in the big leagues. But also we should mention his daughter Diamond DeShields, just drafted a few months ago by the Chicago Sky of the WNBA. So there are plenty of DeShields playing pro sports out there. Let me flip through here the Alan Trammell card. I'm gonna go back to this one. What a beauty of a card. That is just a great shot of Trammell after making contact. Just a beauty of an action shot here. And, of course, Trammell just inducted into the Major League Baseball, or the Baseball Hall of Fame, not the Major League Baseball Hall of Fame. But, you know, it took the Veterans Committee, but he finally got in there. Now we're just waiting for Lou Whitaker to get inducted in the Hall of Fame as well, as he should. Trammell and Whitaker were two of the best middle infielders, and you could argue the best middle infielders, the combination, certainly for the 1980s, and you could argue for basically a 15-year period from, let's see, 78 up through, 93, 94, around there. Two of the greatest. And it's great to see him heading into the Hall of Fame. Of course, Trammell had the embarrassment of being the manager of the Tigers in the god-awful 2003 season, which saw the Tigers lose 119 games, even though they improved drastically in his next two seasons. He's the one who paid the price to eventually build up a Tigers team that was pretty successful about 10 years ago. The last card in the pack here, Will the Thrill Clark, who was featured in our 88 Fleer podcast, which if you go into our archives is episode number 26. You will not only hear my thoughts about the rather patriotic but boring 88 Fleer set, but also the story about me causing a security incident with Will Clark because I was a dumb kid and didn't know any better. But Will the Thrill, known as a red ass because he was a little tightly wound, always seemed to follow in the footsteps of Rafael Palmeiro, not by choice, even though they were teammates at Mississippi State. They just kind of ended up together all the time. But he was a hell of a first baseman and just an outstanding athlete to watch, first with San Francisco, later with Texas, and then several other teams. Let's go into the 90 score set, or pack, rather. The Omar Vizquel, let me look at this. This is a rookie card of Omar Vizquel. And talk about great infield combinations. Omar Vizquel and Roberto Alomar with the Cleveland Indians back in the mid-90s, mid to late 90s, was arguably the next best infield combination after Trammell and Whitaker. And of course, with Alomar in the Hall of Fame, there's a lot of people calling for Vizquel to get into the Hall of Fame. And I think there's a good argument for him to be in there. First of all, he played in Major League Baseball forever. 23 seasons. He was 44 years old when he was playing for the Blue Jays, I think, at the end of his career there, which is just outstanding. But 2,877 hits, a .272 batting average, 11 gold gloves, three-time All-Star. I think the one thing that works against him is some people will say, well, was he that good or did Roberto Alomar just make him that much better? I think it's a good discussion, but not necessarily a great argument as to keeping him out. I do feel, though, that Omar Vizquel, because he played during the steroid era and he's going to get overlooked by the players who hit 500, 600 home runs in their careers, steroid-driven or not. I think he's going to be more in the Tim Raines class, where it's going to take a lot of work, a little timing, and a little luck for him to get into Cooperstown. But he did, and this was his first season this past winter, the first year that he was eligible for the Hall of Fame, did get 38% of the ballot. So not like he's being completely overlooked, but if you need 75 to get in and you're only pulling 38 right now, it is going to be a long road ahead for Omar Vizquel. Guillermo Hernandez, better known as Willie Hernandez, I know our Detroit Tigers fans are going to love this. And by the way, Juan Berenguer was known as Señor Smoke. Okay, I know you're telling me about Aurelio Rodriguez. And yes, Aurelio Rodriguez was also Señor Smoke. But Berenguer was known as Señor Smoke in Minnesota and Atlanta. Certainly not when he was with Detroit, but there can be two Señor Smokes in this world. But Willie Hernandez, the 1984 Cy Young Award winner and American League MVP, he was the first pitcher to do that since Denny McClain in 1968. No, I take that back. To win Cy Young, MVP, and be a World Series winner with the Tigers winning in 84. The first since Denny McClain to do it with Detroit in 1968. Now, after that 84 season, Hernandez was never able to perform the way that he did. He had some good years, but certainly nothing like he'd put up with in 1984. But this was near the end of his career. I think he only had maybe another year in the bigs. But a hell of a career, racking up quite a few saves over the years, just under 200, if I remember. So he often gets overlooked throughout his career, but a key part of not only that 84 world champion Tigers team, but a contending Tigers team throughout that time. The Kirby Puckett Dream Team card here, and the Dream Team set, was always a fun set that SCORE did. And they did, let me see, in 1991, you had the black and white photo Dream Team cards, which the Kirby Puckett card featured him without a shirt, which made you feel extremely awkward and unathletic when you were a teenager looking at the beer barrel chested Kirby Puckett. Puckett was not a... Puckett was kind of chunky, especially because of his height, but he was a pretty impressive physical specimen and still very athletic, even though he was overweight then. You know, last week we were bemoaning the loss of Tony Gwynn, and boy, Kirby Puckett gone way, way, way too soon, not that long ago. Speaking of beer barrel-chested Rick Rushel, who, of course, his brother Paul Rushel pitched in the major leagues as well. Rick Rushel is not exactly somebody you would call svelte, but I love this note. The scouting report, which was voluminous for many players in the SCORE set, well, Rushel had such a long career. He started his major league career in 1972. So by 1990, they're running out of space on the back of his card here. But the scouting report for SCORE is just one sentence. Rick was the big man on the mound for the Giants in their pennant drive, which is true. He came in through the clutch for the Giants in 1989. But big man is a rather nice way of going 6'4", 225 pounds. All right, the name that I keep botching, Dale Mahorsic is how you say it. Dale Mahorsic, nicknamed the horse, as the back of the card says. Mahorsic is a great story because he's a guy who was a 30-year-old rookie with the Texas Rangers in 1986. This is a guy who really battled his way into the major leagues, even though he was a pretty big star player for Cleveland State University. But, you know, it took him a long time to make his way to the big leagues. And he would play for the Rangers and the Yankees. And it even mentions on the back of the card here that, you know, he was, you know, back and forth between AAA in the major leagues in 1989. But Dale Mahorsick, even if you can't say his name correctly, and even though he had a long battle to the major leagues and had a very brief major league career, in fact, 1990 was his last season in the bigs, you may know him better as Dave Spiewak, the starting pitcher of the California Angels in the division playoff game with the Seattle Mariners in the movie Naked Gun. How about them apples? Bet you didn't know that. And now you're going to watch The Naked Gun at some point in time, and you'll see when they're introducing him, you'll go, hey, wait a minute. I know that guy. Dave Spiewak, the starting pitcher for the Angels. In real life, Dale Mahorsick. Brian Harper, another great story. A guy who was making his major league, he had a cup of coffee, a major league debut in 1979, just appeared in one game with the California Angels, but he was stuck in a logjam. He could play catcher, he could play first base, he could play outfield, he could be a designated hitter, but the Angels were stacked in all of those positions then. They had Bob Boone, they had Don Baylor, they had Rod Carew. He had nowhere to go, so he languished in the Angels farm system, then languished in the Pirates farm system, then bounced around St. Louis, Detroit, Oakland, finally making a home in Minnesota in 1988. 89 was like his first full season in the big leagues. So there was a 10-year stretch of him really battling to get to the big leagues. And he was a big part and an often overlooked part of the Twins World Championship in 1991. But a great story of adversity and, you know, pounding through to finally make it to the big leagues. And he had a very long career. He did make it all the way through 1995, where his big league career ended with the Oakland Athletics. And he's been involved in coaching for a very long time, first in the minor leagues, but also at the Players' Choice Academy, which is a youth league. Scott Cooper also involved in youth baseball coaching now. And I mentioned that he was billed as the next Wade Boggs, which, you know, certainly he didn't live up to the expectations, but it is so hard for a player in any position, no matter how talented, to follow in the footsteps of a legend in Boston like Wade Boggs. And even when Boggs moved on to the Yankees in 1992, Cooper really, really struggled. And the Red Sox tried to make the best of it. They put him at third base. They put him at first base. And, you know, he hit 276 one season, which is good. But, I mean, you know, Boggs was hitting, you know, 336 every season. But what's interesting is Cooper was actually a two-time All-Star. He was at the 1993 and 94 All-Star games. He was the lone Red Sox representative. And ironically, in the 1993 All-Star game at Baltimore, Wade Boggs was substituted by Scott Cooper. So even though he was certainly not the next Wade Boggs, he had a very decent career, played on through the 1997 season, even went overseas, played in Japan for a season. But, you know, for a guy who, you know, had to follow in the footsteps of Wade Boggs, I think he had a decent career, but he was certainly no Wade Boggs, and that's not his fault. I mean, a Wade Boggs only comes around only so many times. And then finally, one other Hall of Famer, the last card we pulled from this pack here, the Ryne Sandberg highlight card, which is the defensive record that he smashed in 89, going 90 games in a row without an error. And I think he kept that going for a little while afterwards. But, you know, Ryne Sandberg always puzzled me because when he retired in 1994, I didn't get it. You know, I was just like, you know, wait a minute, how can you, you know, just give up this game? And he was one of the highest paid players at the time. He was making like $7 million a year, which, you know, at the time was absurd. You know, $7 million now is a platoon second baseman. But I didn't get it then. But part of the reason why he retired, and then he did come back for a couple seasons after in 96 and 97, he couldn't live up to the expectations that that contract had. Of course, the Cubs were the lovable losers back then. And he felt, you know, he lost the drive. And that happens not only to athletes, but people like you and me. You know, sometimes, you know, you're doing something, whether it's your job or it's a hobby or something, you know, along those lines. And suddenly the magic is gone. And you know, I didn't understand it when I was, let's see, how old was I back then? I think 17 or 18 years old when he quit. But, you know, as an adult, I understand it now. You know, sometimes you lose that drive. It's hard to get back. But he was able to get it back. A Hall of Famer, and certainly deservedly so. And, you know, former manager of the Phillies, you know, certainly struggled with that team. Not that it's necessarily his fault. But, you know, he is now an ambassador for the Chicago Cubs organization. So some very interesting cards there, interesting sets. Like I said, when opening them, I thought the 90 score set was a big bounce back set for the company that year. I think the 91 Top Stadium Club set again raised the bar in the hobby. You know, for 2 years after Upper Deck came out, all the other card companies were playing catch up. And then once Stadium Club caught up there, then Upper Deck had to catch Stadium Club. And by then, you had all the other premium sets coming out there, which, you know, like I said, was either a good thing or a bad thing, depending on your opinion of the sets. So there we have it. A great opening of a couple packs there. And I will put up a few more packs, three or four packs, probably on Monday. We'll put the poll out there. And this week, I won't tell you what we're putting out there just yet, but I have a hunch it'll be more in the wheelhouse of some of our listeners in the mid-80s, I think. We'll put together a collection of some cello packs that I have, and we'll let you pick and choose. And we'll open up two of the three or four and go through them and look through some classic cards from back then. Again, we're back for the summer, hopefully a lot longer, depending on just how things go in life and support that we get. And we do appreciate your support. Again, please pass along the word that Wax Ecstatic is back. Fridays, noon Eastern, we're posting the shows and the video links to the pack breaks. Also, the PayPal account, if you or a friend would like to make a cash donation of any amount. It doesn't have to be much. We've gotten a few dollars here and there. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Again, paypal.me/waxecstatic. Also, don't forget about that lot of cards I have, the 80-card lot, mostly from the 70s, couple cards from the late 1960s. If you're interested in purchasing them, DM me at Wax and Gum Stains, and we will go ahead and do that. And make sure when you're telling people about the show, we've got lots of different ways for you to listen. Audioboom, iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, Blueberry. It's all out there. There's numerous avenues for you to listen. So however you listen, I appreciate it. I'm glad that you do. I had a lot of fun talking about these cards, talking about how the hobby has changed and why kids are not buying as often as they once did, you know, when we were kids. So again, my challenge to you, your homework for this week, tell us at Wax and Gum Stains, how do you change that? What do we as hobbyists do to get more kids involved in baseball cards? We can't change the baseball card companies. We can't change Major League Baseball. We can't change the history of the hobby in that prices went up. There was a glutton of the cards back in the 90s. There was that strike in 94. We can't change any of that. So what can we, as a hobby, do to get more kids involved? Want to know your answers at Wax and Gum Stains, and we will discuss that next week, as well as open up some more packs. And I had a lot more fun here. I'm Matt Salmon, your host. You've been listening to Wax Ecstatic. We will see you next week.